Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 118, Trouble in the Tribe. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And we're continuing our series on the past, present, and future of the relationship of American Jews and Israel. Building on our conversation from last week with Peter Beinart, our guest today is Dov Waxman, author of the book Trouble in the Tribe, The American Jewish Conflict Over Israel, which looks at the way that Israel was once a topic of unity among American Jews, and now increasingly is a contentious topic that Jews find it really hard to talk about, and that's even resulting in Jews being banned from speaking at different Jewish institutions, being essentially excommunicated, and becoming sort of the opposite of a unifying force in American Jewish life. We're excited to talk to Dov Waxman about the research that went into his book, which came out about a year ago and has just been released in paperback this past week. Dov Waxman is professor of political science, international affairs, and Israel studies, and is the Stotsky Professor of Jewish Historical and Cultural Studies at Northeastern University, where he is also the director of the Middle East Center. He has written other books on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and he's currently working on his next book project called The Israeli-Palestinian Conflict: What Everyone Needs to Know, which will be published by Oxford University Press in 2019. Dov Waxman, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's great to have you.
Thank you for having me on the show.
You know, I always am reluctant when we have a guest who's written a book to ask a question that comes out of the introduction, because it makes it seem like I haven't read the book, and, you know, I actually have. But there was a comment in the introduction to Trouble in the Tribe that really struck me, because our podcast is really about this challenge and this question of all these American Jews who are not really connecting to the institutions of American Jewish life, and kind of what could be done, what could they do to try to find ways to connect to Judaism, despite the fact that they don't connect to the institutions of Jewish life. And what struck me in looking at the introduction to your book was that you talk about how, and I'm quoting you, supporting Israel was an important part of American Jewish life and a central element in the civil religion of American Jewry. And what struck me was that, wow, there was a time in American Jewish history where the kind of people that we're talking about and talking to on this podcast, where they did have an alternative to religious Judaism, to going to synagogue, and that was supporting Israel. And that in some ways, one of the major challenges is that it seems like the group of people for whom the secular Judaism that was exciting and available to them used to be the support of Israel, that Israel is now sort of experiences a problem for a lot of those people. And I was wondering if you could, sort of starting there, if you could give us a sense of, you know, what it is that you found in your examination of where Israel sits in American Jewish discourse today.
The last 100 years or so, Zionism has become functionally equivalent as a form of religious faith, as a form of religious identity for secularizing Jews. So, I mean, the whole question of how can you be Jewish without being religious? How can you do Jewish and be among Jews and find Jewish community if you're a secular Jew? Zionism essentially provided for generations an answer to that question. It allowed Jews not only to feel Jewish, but to be among Jews and to do Jewish and to kind of practice it by, you know, particularly giving money to Israel. And I think that answer, if you like, that answer to the identity needs, the psychological needs, the emotional needs of secularizing and secular Jews it has become both less compelling and problematic in various ways. And so I think that is, in a sense, you know, contemporary American Jews who are struggling with the place that Israel has in American Jewish life are really dealing with a question that goes back to, you know, the 18th and 19th century, in terms of how do Jews remain Jewish as they move away from religion.
I've often thought about this as relating to the Holocaust, but also I think to the founding of Israel, that in a way there were some of these forces in play about, well, what Judaism mean if it was a secular Judaism, that were very much in the air in the late 19th century and the early 20th century. And it's almost like the pause button got pressed on some of those struggles, because both the sort of recovery from the Holocaust and also the project of a new Jewish state being founded, that was at that time at least experienced by a lot of people as sort of an uncomplicated project, was available to them, and it meant that they could avoid some of the challenging issues that had been primary in the air in before the Holocaust and before Israel.
I mean, I think, you know, in the course of the 20th century, you had two revolutionary developments in terms of Jewish politics and the impact it had on Jewish politics. And as you mentioned, the Holocaust and the establishment of the State of Israel. And these two hugely important revolutionary, had a kind of completely upended traditions of Jewish politics and Jewish political argument and debate, and created, not immediately, it didn't happen automatically, but as their impact kind of gradually seeped in to the political life of Jewish communities, both in the United States and around the world, it created this consensus. It created this period of a consensus in Jewish politics that I think was historically unusual, but that many Jews in recent years came to take for granted, came to assume that this strong consensus around the support for Israel, particularly, was the norm. In fact, that Jewish political, almost a kind of monolithic understanding of Jewish politics was the norm, and that was how things should be. In a sense, we're returning back to what is a norm, what is much more normal, I think, historically, at least in modern Jewish politics, which is political pluralism, which is really, you know, debate and deep divisions over not just religious life, but over political life, over the relations between Jews and non-Jews, about what are the prospects for Jewish survival or success in the world. And I think there was this post-war period, really from the 50s, but particularly from the 60s, when the impact of Israel and the Holocaust really started to be most profoundly felt, through to about the 1980s, about a kind of two decades, where there was this very, very strong consensus, chiefly characterized by almost wall-to-wall support for Israel. And we're moving away from that. And I think that's experienced by many people as a kind of crisis, or as a loss and as a threat. And in part, what I'm arguing in the book, in fact, is that period was in fact the exceptional period, the unusual period. And what we're really returning to is the norm, and we just need to learn to accept this and not see this as some sort of threat or aberration.
Yeah, I mean, this is really resonating with me on a number of levels. And what I want to hammer home, I don't want to get away too quickly from this question of Zionism as a stand-in for religion and Israel as a stand-in for religion, because I think people use that phrasing, and it's sort of like used as a ha-ha, funny, like, yes, Israel has become a religion, and I think in other elements of, like, we say, oh, like, the Boston Red Sox are people's religion, but, like, really, really, I think that what people experience emotionally in terms of building communities around sharedness, like that Jewish folks for a while have done that around Israel. And it's not like some surface level pseudo religious thing. Really deep to people's soul, this is what defines their religious identities. And you see this interestingly in communal politics and in institutional politics, where, I mean, you can talk to all sorts of organizations, and if you ask them, like, what is your community's orientation towards keeping kosher? Oh, there's people here that keep kosher. There's people here that hate kashrut. There's people here that have different things in the middle, whatever. What's your orientation towards God? Oh, there's people here that are atheists. There's people here that strongly believe in God. There's people, like, whatever. Like, that's fine. And we're happy to have people involved with every opinion on that particular axis. But then the Israel piece is the one that really defines a lot of communities. I mean, from a flag on the bima, on the stage in synagogue, to who is made to feel welcome and who is not. That's the binding agent. That is the piece that brings people together and builds the community. And so, like, I guess I'd love to hear from you, like, how has that come to be, and what are the ramifications of that for this tribe that you describe as having trouble in the title of your book?
I think there's the kind of, you know, the storyline, the conventional storyline has been simply that Israel was established and American Jews have just been supporting it ardently ever since. And Israel is kind of naturally a central place in American Jewry. And this is some sort of organic, natural development, right? And one of the things I try to do in the book is actually to historicize this relationship with Israel, to say, well, actually, there was a time not very long ago where American Jews were many profoundly ambivalent about Zionism. The Zionist movement struggled to gain support in the United States. We have to understand that support for Israel hasn't been an automatic thing. It's not like just because you're Jewish, you're automatically, or just because there's a Jewish community, it's automatic and inevitable that support for Israel will be central. Even after Israel's establishment, it took at least a decade, more really, before Israel came to occupy the central place it does today in many American Jewish communities. And that in large part came about after the 1967 war. And it's hard to define or identify what a community stands for when there's, you know, some who are, you know, religious, some who aren't religious, some who believe in God, some who don't. And so instead, in an age where increasingly Jews are secularizing and therefore no longer sharing common religious beliefs or practices, Israel and support for Israel becomes the new way of defining and therefore ultimately constituting Jewish communities, because they can say, this is what we stand for. This is what it is to belong in this community. Like many things, something that can be functional for various periods of time can also become dysfunctional at later periods in time, right? The things that can become useful and can bring people together can eventually become the same thing that actually becomes divisive and drives them apart. And I think one of the ways in which this is manifested is precisely that one's politics and one's beliefs about Israel can now be a kind of form of heresy. Right. As you said, you're not going to really be driven out or to feel alienated from a community if you don't believe in God. I mean, that's a remarkable, radical fact of Jewish history, right? That, you know, you can be welcomed in a Jewish community and be a vocal atheist. But it's much more challenging to be a vocal anti-Zionist in many Jewish communities. And so it has become the new dividing line. It has become the thing that is the litmus test, if you like, for whether you are going to be included or excluded from a particular community. And I think for many people today, particularly for younger American Jews, that political litmus test is very, and that's not necessarily because they're opposed to Israel, but they just, you know, don't see why this subject should be the defining feature of what makes you a Jew or an acceptable Jew in the eyes of the Jewish establishment.
Could you give us some examples of some of the events in recent history that you think are really significant in sort of encapsulating some of what you're talking about?
If we take, for example, the responses to Judith Butler as an example, Judith Butler is a very prominent professor in Berkeley, and has a very highly regarded academic career. And on the side is also an outspoken supporter of the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, and has been, I think, on the advisory board or involved with the Jewish Voice for Peace. And forget about her academic work for the moment, but her political activism, and particularly the fact that her Jewishness is central in her political activism. I mean, she doesn't say, you know, I'm that's just my private kind of identity. She's made it central, and therefore she has really become a target for many, I mean, you know, many, you'll often hear many people just, you know, accusing her as being a self-hating Jew or accusing her even, you know, basically being an anti-Semite. Now, these kinds of, it's easy to dismiss, you know, these kinds of allegations and claims. But for example, when I think she was appearing, she was scheduled to appear in a panel at the Jewish Museum in New York on an event about Kafka. She's a literary theorist, so this is within her orbit. And she and the Jewish Museum came under some real pressure to exclude her from this event, based not on her views about Kafka or her qualifications to be on the panel, of her views about Israel. And so this is an example where Jewish institutions, even cultural institutions that have, you know, where it's not even about, the subject of Israel isn't coming up, it wasn't about BDS, are coming under pressure. Certain individuals are now being essentially an attempt to exclude them, or to put it in religious terms, excommunicate them from the Jewish community on account of their views. And so, you know, I mentioned in the book that in some sense it's like the treatment of Spinoza, where you are now, depending upon your views on Israel and Zionism, you are now at the risk of being excommunicated from your community.
I really appreciate you bringing up Judith Butler, and I wanna hone in on that, because like some of the people that are being pushed out of Jewish community, Judith Butler is a giant. Judith Butler, for many, many, many young American Jews, especially, but even not just young American Jews, folks on the left, folks who are interested in just deconstructing the gender binary. I mean, she is the person. And so when something like that happens at the Jewish Museum or anywhere where a person like her is pushed out and there's an attempt to say she's not the right kind of Jew, there are thousands, and I'm not exaggerating, I promise, there are thousands of young American Jews for whom they know they're with Judith Butler. Like it's not like they're not, they don't even feel like they have to choose. Like, they know she's the kind of Jew and kind of person that they admire. And so it's just self-defeating for the Jewish institutions, forgetting the moral implications of pushing people out of communities for whatever political opinions, etc. Like, it's actually just really short-sighted. And I think what we're seeing rapidly happen now, whether it's through the growth of spaces digitally of those people, where those people are centered, actually, and to be a Zionist in a Jewish space is actually out of bounds, or more and more in in-person spaces, the whole conversation is flipping before our eyes. But it seems like folks, I don't know if they're in denial about it or if they just don't see it because it's so distant from their world. I mean, the establishment organizations are really operating in touch with each other and maybe not so much in touch with the folks on the ground. So I guess, like, I'm curious to hear more about what this is saying to, I mean, I have all of my thoughts that I could, but like, what in your study this is communicating to Jews who do feel an affinity for folks like Judith Butler, et cetera, and how they are and what choices they're making about Jewish life as a result of the feeling that their beliefs are sort of not acceptable?
Well, first of all, I think what I refer to in the book is, you know, red lines and black lists. They do, you know, send a message, particularly to a younger American Jews who really see these kinds of, you know, red lines as somewhat arbitrary, for one thing, and as highly restrictive. Even if they don't share somebody like Judith Butler's views, the fact of seeing individuals cast out and demonized or described as self-hating, which is tantamount to calling them anti-Semitic, especially when these individuals are clearly, in her case at least, you know, heavily involved in and actually are involved in Jewishness, and then, you know, really to describe them and to attack them like that, to demonize them, to treat them like that, I think does alienate many people from the Jewish community when they see these kinds of that kind of treatment, and also and I think maybe, you know, deliberately have a chilling effect, right? Because people are therefore worried that they don't want themselves to be the targets of that kind of demonization. So one of the things, and it's obviously impossible really to measure this, I talk about the censorship that is happening, and, you know, I mentioned Judith Butler as just one example. I think actually an even more striking example is the treatment of Peter Beinart, because he's actually a liberal Zionist. So it's saying it's not just anti-Zionists, it's not just supporters of BDS, it's even kind of actually, supporters of Israel, but liberal Zionists who are being demonized. So, what opinion is acceptable? What opinion is a very, very narrow range of opinions. Now, going back to why they do it, I think it's hard to exaggerate the extent to which there is a kind of echo chamber that some members of, in parts of the Jewish community, let's say, parts of the establishment community, where they are really, and it's very easy to live like this today, they are really surrounded by people who agree with them. And therefore, they really do genuinely see these individuals, and they're really convinced that these individuals are both outliers and dangers, precisely because they're just not exposed. They've not really been exposed to other opinions and have come to know other Jews who don't share their views. It is quite easy to actually live in fairly self-contained, isolated, kind of religious, intellectual, cultural bubbles.
For a long period in the past, the vast majority of American Jews, felt about Israel, I don't know, I kind of feel like the way that most people feel about, kale. I mean, it's fine. I don't really love it. I don't hate it. And there was a very small group of leaders of the Jewish establishment who were very much, this is the most important thing in the world. And since there was not really an opposition to them, it was kind of like, okay, well, that's what carried the day. That was kind of what defined, that's the only people that were really talking. And in a way, what's happened today is another very small group of people, many of them young people, have kind of stood up and said, no, we're going to advocate hard for the other side. So really what we're seeing is kind of a debate between two tiny minorities of the American Jewish community and the vast majority of American Jews are kind of, I don't know, I'm curious like where you understand them to be.
I agree. I mean, I think what you're describing is typical of all communities, right? I mean, when American politics is really a debate between small, very small groups, and most people are kind of either apathetic, busy with their lives, preoccupied, don't have the attention span or the time to engage in political debate or political activism. I think that's very important to put that in context. We often get this sense that the kind of Jewish politics and public debate and debates around Israel are sweeping across the American Jewish community, and that, vast numbers of American Jews are engaged in these debates, and it's really a burning issue for many of them. And the fact is, the vast majority are completely unaware that this debate is even happening. I'm currently working on a study of AIPAC and J Street in Boston, based upon a communal surveys that have been done. And remarkably, one of the findings in this study is that many Jews in Boston don't even know of AIPAC or J Street, right? I mean, you would think most of them would be aware. Many of them don't know. And even many of those who do know say they're actually quite supportive of both, despite the fact that they're very different views, which just goes to tell you that what really we are talking about a very small slice, let's say an elite, right, the highly engaged. And when we think about American Jewish life, often there's kind of two different objects of attention. Some sociologists and political scientists and commentators are focusing on the unengaged. And their real concern is the growth of those who are unaffiliated, unengaged, and, the broader, the question of assimilation, if you like. And that's obviously been a major preoccupation for more than a couple of hundred years, but certainly for decades of American Jewish sociologists. We can either pay attention to that group of people, which is growing and important, or what I do in the book is really, I'm not really interested in focusing on the unengaged in terms of those who are just like completely couldn't care less about Israel because they're just, it's just not important. It's not part of their Jewish identity. They're not really engaged in these debates. What I'm focusing on is the engaged, right? The people who are engaged in life, in Jewish life, and engaged in when it comes to Israel. And that is a smaller section, but in all politics, in all political domain, in all societies, we're always talking about that there's only a minority who are kind of politically engaged. So yes, it's in some sense, it's elite, but they are the ones who always shape these wider, wider opinions and attitudes.
One of the things that I think is always ironic, I mean, from the perspective of the claim that the kind of leftist Jews are self-hating, is that the ones that are often being accused of the self-hating, like, those are the ones who actually really, really care. And they, you may not agree with them, but they're the ones who are really trying to say, like, I have to make this mean something, because if I can't make this mean something, then I have to unplug from it, and I don't want to unplug from it because I really, really care. You know, you could argue that the self-hating people are the people who are just not at all engaged. Now, I don't agree with that argument either, but you could at least more plausibly make that argument. So it's strange.
That's why it's such a misunderstanding of you know, Jews on the left, or those who are critical, as if, you know, it and I think it's a way of delegitimizing their opinion, basically, you know, is essentially the argument that they're either, you know, self-hating Jews, or simply just so assimilated and so disconnected from their Jewish identity, or that they don't really care about it. And this is a way, instead of acknowledging and addressing the actual arguments and the actual criticisms, it's a way of saying, you know, well, we don't need to engage with these Jews because they're not really Jews after all. I mean, one of the ways that I think this often I see this is on college campuses. You often hear the claim that Jewish students who are involved in J Street U or Jewish Voice for Peace or If Not Now, who are most active, are disconnected from Judaism, and they are really somehow not being loyal to their Jewishness, and they don't really care about that, and they're just kind of assimilated, or the offspring of intermarried Jews and all of this. And it's nonsense. What you actually see is the Jews who are often the most active in these organizations are also the ones who are most active and most committed to their Jewish identities. And I often say to the people in some of these establishment organizations, they're worrying about completely the wrong thing. They're obsessing about this, you know, small number of Jews who are highly engaged but disagree with them, right? And they're completely missing and not dealing with the much larger number I see on campus who aren't interested at all. If we think about the fact that only one in four Jews has any affiliation, any organizational affiliation, so we're talking probably about no more than, you know, 20% most, at most, of Jews who are engaged in any of this. I do think it has a ripple effect. And one of these things is to create this sense of anxiety, which I think we really are, many American Jews, I mean, maybe that's always the case, but there's this kind of unsettling sense that Israel is no longer the kind of glue that it once was. Israel is no longer the great mobilizing cause or the emotional cause. And they know that that's not really working somehow. It's come some problem. They may blame different groups for this, but there's an awareness of that. And there's a fear then that, well, what can we tell our children then? What can we do? How can we kind of, you know, because remaining Jewish and somehow keeping them in the community is something that is still important to them. So I do think that there's this kind of generalized sense of anxiety. And that's why one of the things I hear very, very often is around these concerns around what's happening on college campuses, because I think that's where this is manifested. And, you know, so it's not that necessarily, you know, a lot of these parents or grandparents very often who I speak to are aware of, you know, the positions of Jewish Voice for Peace or If Not Now or anything like that. But they, you know, they see their child or the grandchild and they know they've got questions, or they're asking questions that they don't really feel that they can answer. And they're worried, therefore, that they're going to kind of, that their kids are somehow going to be drawn away from the Jewish community and from their Jewish identity. And I don't think that fear is well-founded, in the sense that actually, in many cases, or at least in some cases, what's happening is that they're actually creating their own, they're recreating and reinventing Jewish communities. It's the opposite from moving away. In fact, they're moving towards, they're just redefining what it means and finding new forms of doing it. But I do think that anxiety is very real. It's obviously something that various organizations feed off and feed into by exaggerating the kinds of threats that young Jews face, and therefore fueling this kind of anxiety. But obviously anxiety is also, from organizational point of view, effective way of fundraising. I'm not saying that they're being disingenuous and that they actually believe, you know, oh, these, you know, they think, you know, JVP is actually doing good work, but they see it just purely instrumentally. I think it's both they do believe that these things are a threat, but also it happens to be good for business. You know, I get almost on a daily basis, I get letters from all of the Jewish organizations. And if you open most of them up and believed what was in these letters, you would think that every Jewish student attending college or university in this country today is kind of intimidated by their anti-Zionist professors and their, you know, other students, and they're kind of cowering under their desk. And then you're also told to believe that if you just contribute however much money, you will save Israel. You can rescue European Jews and you can protect the future of, you know, young Jews in this country. So, But I also don't think it's purely, I don't want to suggest that they're so cynical that they're basically just saying this purely for fundraising. I think it happens to be both in their organizational interest, but also in their worldview.
Is this about a fear that if we get this wrong, if we blow it, Israel's going to be destroyed and there's going to be another Holocaust? Or is this a fear that is maybe at a kind of a deeper soul level that says it's not necessarily that Israel's going to be destroyed and there's going to be another Holocaust, but like you were saying earlier, that I've kind of grown up and my definition of being Jewish has been about supporting Israel. So if you're now introducing a new kind of way of being Jewish that is less supportive of Israel, it's not that I think Israel's going to be destroyed. It's just that I think Judaism's going to be destroyed because I think that's what Judaism is. You know, or what is the source of this deep anxiety that brings people to the level of saying, I'm willing to even do something so foolish, which is to excommunicate you from the community and lose a generation or a large percentage of a generation of young people because I'm too afraid of what might happen if I open the door to what they want the door open to do?
I would say, I mean, I think it's important always, whenever we're talking about communities or groups of people, to take seriously what their fears. And often, you know, we don't want to just kind of psychologize them away and be dismissive of them. When we're dealing with whether it's American Jews or Israeli Jews, we're dealing with people who are essentially deeply, deeply traumatized. I mean, for very understandable, good reasons, we're still just, you know, not very far away from the Holocaust. And I think the impact that most obviously the Holocaust, but not only, has had is that we are, broadly speaking, a deeply traumatized community where these fears of survival and threats are still very, very keenly felt. And I think it's, and while we may feel relatively secure in our environments and kind of dismiss these kinds of concerns, I think it's important to recognize that people have these things, just the same as I tend to get frustrated when people just dismiss the concerns of Israelis. Maybe they're exaggerated. Maybe they've been manipulated by right-wing politicians or like Israel's current prime minister. But at the same time, we have to understand that this is, you know, in the case of Israelis, they have lived in the conflict situation for decades. They've experienced violence and it's touched many of their lives. So I think when it comes to American Jews, and, you know, it's partly that some of those on that way genuinely do feel that Jewish existence is always precarious and that the anti-Semites are always around the corner. And that, you know, as I said, given the Jewish history, or at least the reading of Jewish history that they've understood, I can understand where they're coming from in terms of having those fears. And it's very difficult, therefore, to have a kind of straightforwardly kind of rational conversation where you're talking to people sometimes who are, you know, really caught up in these fears. The other thing, though, I think is, aside from the kind of security concerns and threats, as you note, is there's a kind of identity anxiety. There's a kind of sense that their own understanding of Jewish identity, their own way of being Jewish is just not as compelling or as successful today. So we're often having two kinds of discussions at the same time, a discussion about us and about identity and about what it means to be Jewish and how important Israel and Zionism is and how you display loyalty and what does loyalty mean. And another argument about Israel itself and about the threats to Jews and about anti-Semitism.
I really appreciate a number of levels of this. And I want to so you're talking about how individually, so folks who are getting the letters in the mail, for them, they may have this deeply built identity where Israel stood for the main components or even only components of their Judaism. I think that's true. I also want to reflect institutionally, there's a worry, because if you look at, say, all of the organizations that are in the Conference of Presidents of major American Jewish organizations, if you counted up how many had the word Israel in their title, or how many, at the very least, maybe it's not in their title, but they've devoted a massive percentage of their work to the support of Israel, it is a very real question that they would ask, not just as individuals, but institutionally, well, if Israel is not our main purpose, what the heck are we? Genuinely, what would it, and I don't mean that, like, I'm not saying that to demean them. I'm saying I actually understand that is a deep, huge question that an institution who wants to continue to exist is like, well, if we've been doing 60% of our work gathering American Jews in support of Israel, and that's not going to be the main thing anymore, like, what replaces that? I have no, like, I don't have a good answer. And I empathize, but I also really want to push them to start thinking about it, because it's not going to speak to the numbers it did. And I reflect on the generational piece that you brought up. I was at a meeting. There were a bunch of Federation executives that gathered a meeting, and I was there. I was on a panel of like college students at the time. I was a senior in college, and we were talking about the college campus question that you bring up. And so they were asking all these questions from the space of, well, if Israel's not going to be this unifying piece anymore, what is it going to be? And I pointed to them and I said, so it was summertime. I said, you see over there how there's a table with a bunch of appetizers and coffee and stuff? We were in just some random conference room. And I said to them, so today's the 17th of Tammuz. And I don't know how many of you care about that, but for me, it's a deeply meaningful fast day. And I'm sitting in a space with a bunch of Jews and having a perfectly good conversation. And I'm okay with being in a room that has food, even though I'm not eating. And like, I'll tell you, a few hundred years ago in Europe, it may have been a much bigger deal to not be fasting on that day than whatever you think about some conceptions of Israel. I mean, it's anachronistic to talk about Zionism in the early 1800s, but like, even in the late 1800s, it would be a much more significant thing to say this fast day, we're going to have a bunch of food in the corner. And I said, like, that to me is not bad. I'm not saying that you should eliminate the food in the corner. I'm saying we have a Judaism or sets of Judaisms that are able to speak to different kinds of people. And we don't need to worry self-esteem wise that if Israel goes away, there's nothing compelling. And it's not that there's 1.5 million people that are going to be psyched about fasting on the 17th of Tammuz to remember the like shattering of tablets by Moshe. Like that's not the point I'm making. It's just that we need to have that self-esteem to think, oh, there's actually really cool things in Judaism that are not just Israel.
For many years, there was the underlying assumption in Western societies that that religion, not just Judaism, religion was a spent force, but that, you know, modernization meant secularization, and that over time, each generation would be progressively more secular and religion would gradually fade away. And you know, so so that was the assumption. And then given that assumption that modernity meant increasing movement away from religion, the belief was that, well, Zionism and support for Israel is a very effective antidote to this secularization process. But now, essentially, some younger Melkites say, hey, we've actually got Judaism, right? We don't need this other thing. We've actually got the real thing. And that's a very surprising thing to their parents or grandparents for whom Judaism was what their grandparent did and left. And so it's a completely shift. It's a shift in attitude, I think, more broadly about the role that religion plays in our life and the kinds of ways in which one can do it.
I find it fascinating that you're talking about sort of right, what's going on as that, in a sense, that there are young American Jews who are finding Judaism again, whether it's Judaism as a religion or some other form. But then it really strikes me as interesting that what we're then potentially looking at is a battle among two Judaisms, right? Because as you've pointed out in your book, and many people point out, that Israel, even though, of course, there's a huge secular population, it's very reasonable, I think, to argue that Israel is becoming more and more influenced by the Orthodox and by the ultra-Orthodox and by the settlers who are mostly Orthodox. And then in America, we're seeing also a Judaism, a growing, enriching Judaism that is much sort of earlier in its development, but that's certainly very live for young people. And I wonder, right? I mean, at that point, once we're seeing this as potentially an argument between two Judaisms, then you can a little bit understand more what's at stake and what's the anxiety, as we've talked about, the identity anxiety. But you also, I feel it leads you to be a little bit more pessimistic in the sense that, in the sense of some long-term accommodation being reached, you know, because it seems that religious battles tend to become schismatic rather than some middle ground being found.
Absolutely. So first of all, I agree with you the way you characterize it. I sometimes say that, you know, the battles that are taking place, first of all, is a transnational one. It's not simply, and they feed into each other. It's not between American Jews on the one hand, who are sometimes described as a kind of monolithic community, and Israel on the other. We have, you know, often the discussion is Israel versus American Jewry, and that there's these two groups. In actual fact, I see Israeli Jews are riven by their own internal divides. There's an identity debate that was actually the subject of my first book, was about how ultimately the debate over the Oslo peace process in Israel was really a debate over Israeli identity, and in a mainly ways a conflict between what I call a kind of Israelis versus Jews. And so there's this transnational dimension that essentially it's competing ideas of Judaism, but also about Jewish history and Jewish identity. And understanding the debate in those terms, understanding that it is actually derivative of a much deeper debate about the meaning of Jewishness, about Judaism, about Jewish history. Yes, on the one hand, it suggests that that debate is not likely to end anytime soon. And that's exactly why I argue ultimately in the book for the need for political pluralism, because this isn't just something that's going to stop when Netanyahu leaves office, if he ever does. You know, when things change in Israel, there's this idea that, oh, if just this happened or just that happened, then, you know, we'd all go back to being, you know, one big happy family. No, these are deeply rooted debates in Jewish history. And I think they're not going to go away. And I think, therefore, we have to actually accept the existence of these debates and the legitimacy of these debates and understand that these debates aren't new to Jewish history. In fact, they've been a feature of Jewish history for a very long time. And it's really that is under ultimately what we're arguing about, not simply Israeli policy or, the, you know, or in the American context, whether, you know, BDS. But beneath that, there's actually, I think, much deeper divides and cultural debates. So ultimately, we're arguing about who we are as a people and what that means and what are the elements of that. And that argument is not going to disappear.
Well, that connects to another issue. You know, I was thinking when you said if Bibi Netanyahu ever leaves office, you know, I was thinking about Donald Trump's doctor, you know, who said if he ate a little better, he could live to be 200. You know, and I wonder if the same might be true of Bibi Netanyahu, who probably does eat better. So I worry. But, you know, one of the questions, though, I think that really comes out, I mean, I think that your book was published before the election of Donald Trump, and it's what we're seeing in terms of Donald Trump is we're both seeing that many American Jews who are particularly Orthodox ones who put Israel at the center of their worldview are supporting Donald Trump in a way that the vast majority of the rest of the American Jewish community does not. And we're seeing Bibi Netanyahu very much linking his policies to Trump. And I think that from the perspective of a great many American Jews who vote Democrat and have always voted Democrat, you know, this is just a disastrous connection of Israel with not only the Republican Party, but with Donald Trump. And it just feels like it's going to exacerbate any of these divisions all the more so. And it also connects to, I think, what you've been talking about, that what we're seeing in terms of attitudes towards Israel is not distinct necessarily from the cultural divisions that are happening in the United States having nothing to do with Israel. And it's not that Orthodox Jews are supporting Donald Trump only because of his assumed support for Israel. It's because they also accept a lot of the other things that he's standing for.
Yeah, I mean, I thought about this a lot because I did finish the book before he was elected. And I thought about, you know, does this change my argument? Does it? And in fact, maybe most authors, you know, believe this. I really think it reinforces the point. I think actually, exactly as you said, I think what we've seen since Trump come into office is an exacerbation of these trends that I describe in the book. Fundamentally, we see a growing, the main divide is, of course, between the non-Orthodox Jews, who are overwhelmingly opposed to Trump, and the Orthodox Jewish community, which is largely supportive. But not, it's not only an Orthodox, non-Orthodox. That, I think, is the biggest difference. We also obviously see that between liberals and conservatives as well, to some extent. So I think underlying the debate around Israel was a divide between, let's say, on the one hand, secular liberals, who tended to be also younger, and religious conservatives. Generally speaking, that's the underlying secular liberals, religious conservatives. And that divide has only widened since Trump has come into office. Before Trump was in office, the struggle between secular liberals and religious conservatives within the Jewish community here was played out largely over Israel. Now we're seeing that struggle being played out in a host of different ways, no longer just about Israel. And in fact, I think the one thing that Trump has done in terms of what I'm looking at hasn't reconfigured the battle lines. They've just become more deeply entrenched. But the focus, I think, has shifted somewhat away from Israel and away from the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to actually focusing attention on new sets of battles here at home. And so to some extent, what may happen in the long run is that the centrality of Israel as the main issue of debate may actually shift. And to some extent, that will lead to maybe a decline in the intensity of the debate over Israel. That's one possible scenario. The other scenario is if they see these things as connected, which I think many do. They see actually what's happening in Israel and what's happening in the United States and the forces behind that as connected, then that intensifies the struggle because they understand it to be really what it is, which is a transnational one.
I've been saying recently that for all of those who somehow think that they're going to get American Jewish students on campus to sort of think in some uncritical way about Israel, it's like in an environment in which they spend all their waking moments thinking very critically about the United States and about its leadership, there's no way that they're going to have a different attitude towards a different country. And so it just reinforces the quixotic notion that somehow you're going to be able to change the way that folks are thinking about Israel based on some philosophy as opposed to the realities of their day-to-day life.
And they're more politicized. I mean, one of the, I don't want to call it the positive side effects, but of Trump coming into office as a political scientist, let me speak at least from that point of view, that people are much more politicized today. Mm-hmm. And that politicization doesn't generally stay within one area, right? You don't generally say, I'm politicized here and then not here. And particularly given the close embrace between Netanyahu and Trump, in some ways, the Trump administration and Trump personally isn't doing Israel any favors because his brand is so toxic among American Jews that it actually ends up polluting other brands and it's affecting Israel as well in that respect. So the processes that we're seeing are actually, I think, since Trump's come in, it's become even more apparent that, there is this right that if younger Jews who previously maybe weren't paying attention, they're like, well, if Netanyahu likes Trump so much, what's the matter with Netanyahu? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of the logic, essentially.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. And for some, I mean, there's been polling suggesting that Israelis writ large are among the most Trump supportive populations in the world, which brings up a whole other set of issues beyond just the leadership in the government. But we don't have too much time to go there. Thank you so much for joining us. I really just so deeply appreciate your deep immersion in all of these questions and bringing them to our listeners. I mean, this is going to lead us to think in a variety of new ways, and hopefully our listeners too.
Great. Well, it's been I've thoroughly enjoyed the conversation, and thank you for having me on the program.
And thanks so much to all of you out there for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we want to close it out as we always do by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can always hit us up on Twitter at Judaism Unbound. Next, you can head to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last plug we'd like to make is that you can always support us with a financial donation, either on a monthly recurring basis or a one-time basis. You can do either of those at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.